I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. Omar Alekha joins me again. The best-selling author and reporter has just published a new book, One Day Everyone Will Have Always Been Against This. It's a powerful book where the author chronicles how his own life fits within the narratives of the worlds he inhabits as a son of immigrants, as a father, as a citizen, and whether it's journalism in Canada, living in the United States, being a writer, he speaks truth to power. This book is described as a powerful reckoning with what it means to live in the heart of an empire that doesn't consider you fully human. The title of the book is adapted from a tweet Omar put out in October 2023, 3 weeks after the bombardment of Gaza. Going back from then, he reflects on his work as a journalist, a career that began in university just after September 11, 2001. He takes the timeline of then and now and provides examples of how he views the West as no longer to be trusted to police the world, morally or otherwise. I'll ask Omar about the writing of the book and the conclusions he comes to, deeply personal ones that call into question home, as well as electoral politics, the media, and what it means to be an artist. Omar Alekha has reported from Afghanistan, Guantanamo Bay, and New Orleans during Hurricane Katrina. He's been on the program in the past for his previous novels, American War and What Strange Paradise. Both were bestsellers and critically acclaimed. This new book is published by McClelland and Stewart. We spoke 1 week ago with Omar joining me from Toronto. Please welcome back to the Plant Online program, Omar Alekha. Mr. Alekha, good morning.
Thank you so much for having me. How are you doing?
Pretty good yourself.
I'm all right.
The thing that I kept thinking about as I was reading your book, Omar, is I don't know how to put this. How do you not let the anger, let the indignation that one rightfully should feel about what's happening in the world today, how do you not let that consume you?
It's a really good question, and I apologize in advance for my deeply unsatisfactory answer, even though I've been thinking about this for a long time. To me, it comes down to a few things. The first is the innate knowledge that I don't have the talent of the kind of writers that I aspire to, or that have done exactly what you're talking about so much better than I ever could. I'm thinking here of the James Baldwins of the world. You know, I often go back to this interview that James Baldwin did, I think it was with the Paris Review, back when he was living in Paris, and the interviewer being convinced that this was some kind of great literary adventure, you know, that he was following in the footsteps of Hemingway, and Baldwin trying to explain, no, I had to leave the United States. I was too angry to be a black man in that country. They would have killed me. And so to say that he took that anger and turned it to something deeply profound on the page, I think would be an understatement. I don't have that talent, and you can see the places where it gets away from me. But I'm cognizant of at least that possibility existing, and I at least try to reach for it. The other aspect of it is that for me, the defining aftertaste of this book is not rage, although the rage is clearly there.
Mm-hmm.
It's a kind of uncertainty. Because this thing I'm talking about, this thing that I feel has betrayed me, is also the thing that I've been anchored to for the entirety of my life. You know, it's the reason I sound the way I do. It's the reason I have the cultural knowledge base that I do. And so to come untethered from that, of course, involves a lot of anger. Of course, involves rage. But more than that, it involves a kind of uncertainty. I don't know who I am on the other side of this. So that has sort of tempered the anger rising to the surface. And finally, you know, I'm a guy named Omar who's writing a really controversial book. I know full well that if I let it get away from me, the imagination of what I could be capable of or how I'm perceived is essentially unlimited. And so even as a function of survival in the context in which I exist, I have to be cognizant of that. So those are the closest things I can come to an answer, but yeah, I thought about that quite a bit.
In the book, you talk about the writing of this book, and you know, there's serious discussion that you have with others about publishing it. You know, how would it affect you, your career, the others involved, like your publisher, your editors at all. There's one person that you talked to, and somebody from your publisher who said, you know, the quick turnaround would probably make some of the book irrelevant. And then, you know, as I'm reading the book, you know, during the time that I read it, that's not how it's turned out. Because you also talk in the book about the professional toll. Not just you, but artists have endured as a result of speaking out. That cost, I think, should not be overlooked. And I'm sure you don't want to say dwell on yourself personally, but I mean, others have withstood greater harm to their not just their livelihoods, but their lives itself, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, again, I come to this idea of uncertainty because there's two sort of colliding thoughts that come to mind when you talk about that. The first is that, yes, absolutely. I mean, in my case, the effects have been fairly minimal in the sense of, you know, who cares if I lose the film rights deal to one of my novels? I mean, I've been lucky to publish anything at all to begin with. And to be perfectly honest, some of the stuff that's been canceled on me is stuff I really didn't want to do in the first place. Mm. So there's an element of a little bit of relief, at least in some cases, to know who you're working with or you know, better to know it up front than later on. But, I mean, a lot of these young and new writers who have overwhelmingly been the ones to speak up, and you don't have to agree with their positions, but these are people who must have known that if they just kept their head down, it would have been so much better for their careers, careers which are still relatively in their infancy.
Yeah.
And it's been incredibly disheartening to see these people, really, really talented writers in my case, but I suppose artists across the board, really suffer over this. So that's one thought, but immediately collides with the other, which is that you and I are talking right now, and as best I can tell, our neighborhoods haven't been razed to the ground, and our extended family hasn't been wiped off the face of the earth. The scale of repercussions and the scale of what might be called a negative consequence is so difficult to sort of think about in terms that are not immediately drawing one back to the horror that I've seen over the last year and a half. And so it's very difficult for me to make too much of a deal about any of this. And I think this speaks to sort of wider sense that I have that a lot of things that really would have mattered to me in an almost existential way 2 or 3 years ago, things like getting a positive review in the New York Times or selling enough books to be able to publish the next one or all of that stuff, really doesn't feel like it matters anymore. And it sort of changed my perspective about all of this stuff.
Well, one of the people, Omar, that you write about in the book that I just found fascinating to read about his story and his life is your father. His was not an easy life, you know, having to leave Egypt and trying to find work elsewhere, you know, even here in British Columbia at one point. What if his life do your children know?
That is a question I've never been asked before. And it's really, really interesting. They know that Giddu died, they were born. Uh-huh. They know that his first name is my middle name. They know that he would have loved them dearly. He was an only son, and I was his only child. He had two stepsisters, but they were much older than him. And so I think for him, they would have been just the most amazing thing. You know, my father, when I think of his life, yes, there's an element of something tragic there in the sense that he loved Egypt, but he also despised its government, and he despised its lack of opportunities and its lack of freedom. And I think, like a lot of men of his generation and my generation too, you managed to translate that that fury at the country of your birth into a kind of longing for anything else. I think I wish my children obviously would have gotten to meet him. And I wish too that you know, for many reasons, but one of them being that he was anchored. You know, ironically, he moved around for so much of his life.
Mm-hmm.
But he was born and raised in a place, and he knew that place down to the marrow. And so when I sit around and I try to explain Egypt to my kids who have never, you know, seen anything like Cairo and who would probably lose their minds if I put them in downtown traffic in Cairo,
yeah.
You know, I have to explain it in a way that is far more abstract, that is coming from the point of view of somebody who left when he was five and returned occasionally but was never anything there. And my father wouldn't have done that. My father would have given them something much closer to the marrow. So for that and many, many other reasons, it's one of the great sort of saddening aspects of life that they didn't get to meet.
There's an episode that you describe in the book. He was working here in B.C. at a hotel in Harrison Hot Springs at the time. And he decides that you, I think your mom as well, to go to the United States to see a relative. And you're stopped at the border there in Abbotsford. He's denied entry. And you obviously have, you describe in the book how you felt and how you reacted to the situation and contrasted that to how he felt. It's a very different reaction from yours. And I guess it says something about how your relationship with the so-called West has changed. But I'm more interested in how he viewed, say, what we call the West.
Yeah, I think for my father, who you know, in his youth had always wanted to become a mathematician, he was obsessed with rationality, with the idea that 1 + 1 = 2, and the notion of sort of presenting your position, but then explaining how you got to that position. He was, and I think a lot of the Arab men I grew up around held on desperately to the idea of rationality, which sounds like a ridiculous thing to say. We should all hold on to the idea of rationality.
Mm-hmm.
But for him, I think there was, you know, having grown up in a place where if the government says the sky is red, then the sky is red, I think it becomes much more alluring to believe that the world outside of that context is deeply rational, and that if you just make the case and you show your work and 1 + 1 = 2, then you will be on the right side of the argument. And so whenever he was presented with these kinds of situations, you know, we tried to cross the border. It was right around the time of that, I think it was called the Millennium Bomber, the guy who wanted to blow up the Space Needle, I think, mm-hmm. in Seattle. And so security was really high, and they just decided to err on the side of not letting an Arab family in. For me, it was, my anger was, I think, a function of my own obliviousness, in the sense that I believed personally that I had done the work to shed enough of my old self and to become acceptable to this place enough that this sort of thing should never happen. Whereas my father, who I don't think would have ever been so arrogant and to sort of subscribe to that same notion, what stuck out for him is that when the Americans refused to let him in and sent him off to the RCMP to do a check on him,
mm-hmm.
and the RCMP guy came back and said, "We don't know why you were sent back," that was the victory for him, because something rational had happened. You know, he was not crossing the border to try and bomb the Space Needle. He was crossing the border to try and see one of his best friends. And there had been some statement that validated his position as the rational actor in the situation, and I think for him, that was the thing to hold on to. Whereas for me, there was this kind of indignant rage that, no, this doesn't happen to people like us.
Yeah.
We did the work, don't you understand? And so I feel, you know, as with so much of what's in this book, I feel a great sense of shame and complicity in a lot of the things I'm indicting, because I am a part of this. You know, from the age of 5, I've been a part of this.
Yeah, you take on in the book, you know, how journalism, how the media conducts itself in covering certain stories. You take on electoral politics even. You narrate in this book, it's described as, the book is described as a breakup of sorts. I don't want to reduce it to simply that, but this complicated relationship that you have and that a lot of people have had with their idea of, say, living in Canada or living in the United States, and what's changed for them, and what's changed for you. Do you, looking back, I think it's easy to say in hindsight to see that this so-called breakup was inevitable. I mean, are there places in time, I mean, you know, whether it was your career, say, in journalism, as you started writing novels, as you went out promoting novels, could you have seen it, how it would have turned out for you and how your feelings have all changed, say?
I mean, the way I've been describing it as of late is sort of like how Hemingway's character went bankrupt, you know, little by little and then all at once. There's so many moments that come to mind where I had to reassess the sort of underpinning of how I thought about the place that I now believe myself to belong to. Things I saw in Afghanistan, things I saw in Guantanamo Bay, things I saw while living in the United States. You know, individual moments that, and again, this goes back to complicity, I was able to ultimately compartmentalize and not think of as being part of a wider rot in the load-bearing beams, but rather a series of horrible instances. And I think that all sort of came to an end over the last year and a half. And I think perhaps if I'd been a less naive person or a less oblivious person, maybe I'd come to these conclusions earlier. But I didn't. The thing about the last year and a half is that there's a sense of immediacy and intimacy, and again, complicity, that is just different from anything else I've seen in my lifetime. In the sense that I wake up every morning, I open my computer, and I see evidence of the worst things human beings can do to one another. And I know that my tax dollars are funding it. I know that I am doing this. You know, I can tell you that I'm a pacifist, and I can believe that. I can believe that I abhor all violence of any kind. But by virtue of how my tax dollars are spent, I'm one of the most violent human beings on earth. And my ability to escape that reality simply came to an end. And so I know that the publisher talks about this idea of this being a breakup letter with the world. But to me, it's more specific than that. I think it's a breakup with the ideological underpinnings of Western institutions, be they political, cultural, journalistic. In terms of individual solidarity and individual action, I think I'm more hopeful at this point in time than I've ever been in my life. I've seen people commit acts of incredible bravery and risk their livelihoods, risk their social standing, their career aspirations, risk arrest, risk violence, all to stand up for something. And so I make that distinction, I think, between how I feel about Western institutions at that level, at the institutional level, and how I feel about human beings, because those are two completely opposed reactions that I've had over the last year and a half.
Yeah, I have to say, after reading the book, you know, I had this sort of hangover with it in terms of, like, I felt terrible about, you know, everything that's happening in the world, you know, as I'm witnessing it. And at the same time, I'm thinking, it's not all that hopeless. I mean, you are, as you just said, quite hopeful, and it's not all bleak, is it?
No, I mean, I don't think so, but I should say that there are many days when I wake up and the impulse to get out of bed just isn't there. Like the dejection feels overwhelming and the cynicism and all of it, right? I remember a long time ago, this has stuck with me ever since, I was on a panel, a virtual panel for a climate anthology, climate essay anthology, and the final question was something like, you know, where do you derive hope and what does hope mean for you and that sort of thing. And everybody gave the sort of answers you'd expect, except the last guy, whose house had burned down in the California wildfires not too long earlier. And he said something like, there is no hope. We've messed up the planet so much that there is no coming back from this. There is no hope, but we must act as though there is. And I think about that a lot because I think if I felt like I was operating in a vacuum, I would have quit a long time ago. but I think there's something particularly cowardly about giving up on somebody else's behalf. And in this case, it's not just these human beings that I've been watching slaughtered and subjected to all manner of humiliation and violence, not just for the last year and a half, but for decades. It's also my own children, right, with respect to some of the issues that I cover in this book. Like, I can't abdicate on their behalf. And so a lot of these things factor into a very complicated relationship I have with hope. But certainly I do mean it when I say I'm more hopeful now than I have been at any other point in my life.
Yeah, that's the other thing that I took away from the book, is that we do have a part to play in terms of, say, witnessing what's going on elsewhere. And, you know, you talk at the end of the book about keeping accounts, say, or accounting of what people have done in the sword, and the people who have been quiet and silent and not said anything through all of this. And the line that I talking about this hangover that I've had, that I keep thinking about as I've been thinking about the book in the days since I finished it, is none of this was ever necessary. And I can't explain what that's sort of felt for me as I've been thinking about the book in the days since I finished it. I'm sure you think about that a lot in terms of say, looking back at the last 18 months and change about what's happened to the world, say. I mean, I can't help but think that one thinks that every day, even.
Yeah, and about no shortage of issues, right?
Yeah.
I mean, especially today, you and I are talking and the entire country is apocalyptic about something that was absolutely not necessary, right? Mm-hmm. We're watching this sort of trade war break out, and a lot of people are going to suffer as a result. And again, you can't help but think, none of this was ever necessary. A few years ago, in the middle of the COVID lockdown, I remember reading this essay, and I apologize, I forget the writer's name, but I think it was in the Globe and Mail. And this writer was talking about this idea of, I think, you know, watching people hoarding toilet paper.
Yeah.
and sort of that panic impulse, and thinking about how, in that writer's case, what this lockdown had actually done was not sort of produce that impulse to hoard or to take as much as you can for yourself and let everyone else sort of deal with it, but rather that it had clarified just how little one needs to be happy, and how much of that can't be bought from the Costco. You know, just the sort of the ability to sit with someone you love and feel safe, and that sort of clarifying instinct, I think, had a really profound effect on me, because especially now I live in a country that is so deeply individualistic that you're watching the sort of illogical conclusion of all of this in the form of the world's richest man effectively stripping the country for parts. And there's a kind of insatiableness that permeates. And I think it's what brings us to these places where you look at something horrific happening and think to yourself, this wasn't necessary. This is a result of a select small group of human beings' insatiable desire, a gaggle of billionaires, a gaggle of people for whom there is no such thing as enough. And I think about that a lot because the country I live in considers it almost like gospel.
So you live in the United States, just outside of Portland. I'm talking to you from Vancouver. You're in Toronto. We spoke briefly about Egypt a moment ago. I'm curious to know this idea of home, because a lot of writers come to this in terms of their work, in terms of their careers. What feels like home for you?
Yeah, I think about this question a lot. I did an interview earlier today where before we went on air, the interviewer was like, so let me get this straight. Egyptian, Canadian, American.
Yeah.
Am I missing anything? And I was like, you know, I get it. It's a lot of hyphens. I've never really had much of a relationship with the idea of the nation state, just as a result of the kind of upbringing I've had. I'm not a particularly patriotic or nationalistic person in any sense.
Uh-huh.
You know, I have nothing against people who are, and I think if I had a different life, maybe I would have been, but I'm not. And so for me, home has really, not since I was a teenager, been a place. For me, home is memory and relationship. And so, you know, late last year, I went back to Qatar to teach for a month. Georgetown has a campus there, and they invited me to teach a creative writing class. And I landed in this place, and the moment I felt home was not when I was walking around the city I grew up in. It was when I was riding around with an old high school friend of mine, and I found myself subconsciously, without even knowing it, reverting to that weird mix of English and Arabic that we used to speak when we were in high school, with like Qatari curse words and just sort of like this mess that outside of a very particular upbringing, nobody would really sort of understand much of. For me, home is people. I mean, Portland started to feel more like home after my kids were born there, because I can look to the railing near the stairs and I can see the little height markers that we've put for them as they've grown up. But it'll never be a function of citizenship. I'll never tell you, well, home for me is being Canadian or being American. That ship has sailed for me. Mm. And there's a part of me that hopes that that isn't the case for my children, because I want them to feel that. You know, it's a lot of heavy lifting when you don't have that to lean on. But for me, that just, I don't think is ever going to be the case.
It's such a beautiful book. As I said, you know, I enjoyed reading about your father. There's stories in here that are that I would have liked to touch on, but I think for people listening, they're better savored having read the book as a whole. It's a very fine achievement, and I wish you well, Omar. I can't help but think that a lot has gone into this book, more than just, say, writing itself, and it's a gift for those of us who've read it. Congratulations and continued good luck with not just the book, but everything else.
Thank you so much. It was very, very generous, and I appreciate the chance to get to talk to you.
The book is called One Day Everyone Will Have Always Been Against This. It's published by McClelland & Stewart. It's author Omar Alaka. Join me on the line from Toronto and Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.